Kick it. One, two, three.
Who's the best show here?
Best show!
That's old that shit.
Come good. On.
That was terrible. Try it again. Wow. Who's the best show here?
Best show!
Right. That's right. Okay. Now.
Pizza, pizza.
P.O. Showtime!
Well, you were making egg foo young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
That's how I got hired at Chippendales.
It's a little thing to show when that's fact. If you don't like the cats, you can stick it up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies that a Lincoln bat. For the strong link, go direct to DLNTS.org. And ICChallenge, LinuxLink.net. Bound Tech Show. Just sit right there, cause the cats are just about to begin.
Welcome to episode 836 of Linux Link Tech Show. On the show tonight, we have Pat.
Happy, happy.
We have Joel.
Good evening.
And maybe Joe, if he gets the opportunity.
You can't see me.
I am. And Trolls is supposedly there. I don't know if his mic's working. He had some stuff he'd like to share with if he can get it working. But before we get to this, now I don't usually like to bring these things up, but I felt that at the risk of getting to meme I'm sure you all saw the Tapper AirPod carrying strap sold at Nordstrom's for $60.
Actually, no.
Really? You haven't? So this, you're gonna love it. This is beautiful. This is for the AirPods. I think the AirPods are $120 or thereabouts, if I'm not mistaken.
One of those stupid things. Okay.
Yeah. So you can get. So to avoid losing your AirPods, you can order a $60 strap that attaches to each of them.
Or for $50, you can get a pair of LG headphones like I use all the time and not have the problem at all.
But see, here's the thing, right? Like, it's. You are just a few inches away from attaching a connector on the end of that and plugging it right into the phone, right? What's the point of that? And $60 on top of it is absolutely outrageous for two little connectors on a piece of string. If you actually look at it, it's obscene. Rated almost four stars. Nine people have rated it 4 stars. It is ridiculous. Now, Joel, I would counter that. You, for the price of $60, that's how much I paid for the last 6 headphones that I bought over the years. The last 6 headphones. And you know what? That's probably an exaggeration. I would probably say it would be more like 8 pairs of headphones because, you know.
I just ordered 5 of the HPS 510s from LG for $15.
Yeah, but those are all broke, right?
Yeah, so what? No. I fixed 3 of them.
So when you order 5 of those like that, is your expectation that you will be able to get like 2 or 3 of them to work by cannibalizing parts from the other ones?
Yeah, I assume a minimum of 50% is going to get fixed. Now, if it's one of the older LGs, like the 510s or the 770s, which are the non-retractables, I'm going to assume that I'm going to be able to get like 75% fixed or 100% fixed, depending on what's wrong with them.
Wow, that strap there is like way over price. Same strap for like $7. It's
right.
Just not as nice.
So if you put the AirPods together with the strap, you're looking at what, $180?
Yeah.
That's like more than the last 6 MP3 players I bought.
There is a reason I will not buy AirPods. That's actually one of them. That and the other is
because the battery sucks and the sound sucks more.
Both. Yeah, those are good reasons. Probably the bigger reason is they don't freaking fit my ears.
It has nothing to do with being $120 to begin with?
No, it does. That has a lot to do with it, too. But even if I was willing to spend that much on them, I wouldn't buy them mostly because they don't fit my ears. Because I have a wired set that's sitting in my desk drawer over here that came with my work iPhone that I never use. So it's like, yeah. But was this a Black Friday deal too?
I don't know if it's wow.
Now I didn't really, well, I guess technically I did get one Black Friday deal. I bought through Amazon, I got a combination of the Ring doorbell and a Echo Show 5. The Echo Show 5 is actually sitting here in my office. Probably the one
thing
I like.
Is that the Amazon Echo?
Yeah. Yeah,
so the doorbell is for the Amazon delivery stuff?
The doorbell basically, they won't be able to open my door. They'll just be able to ring it. But basically, it's got camera built. Like, it's a doorbell button with a camera built into it, like a 1080p camera on it with a real wide angle on it. So I can actually set motion detectors on that so that it'll start recording the minute somebody hits my porch, which is nice in case somebody's pilfering packages and I'm not home. And the other thing, too, is they can ring the doorbell. And even if I'm not home, I can know somebody rang my doorbell, which is kind of nice. So,
wait, I got it. So is the camera actually on the part of the doorbell that you push the button?
Yep. It's like right above the button.
No, so it's not in the button itself. So they're not actually pushing the... So that you're not reading their fingerprint too while you're
correct.
Yeah, although that would be interesting to read their fingerprint too.
The one thing I did discover, like I can go, Alexa, show me my front door, and then it'll open the camera up on my Echo Show, which is kind of nice. And then I guess when somebody hits the doorbell.
What the hell is an Echo Show? I've never heard of an Echo Show before.
It's basically the Echo, but with the screen. It's like their version of the Home Hub. Alexa, go home. I just told it to go home, so it goes back to the normal clock that it has. But basically, it's the same thing as a Home Hub, but it's Amazon's version of it. So, but the one thing I discovered, it works great with that. But you know, Amazon, you know, they're not real Google friendly, you know. So there's actually no real integration I can't bring the camera up on the Home Hub in the kitchen. But I can do things. I can have it talk to Ring and say and tell me, well, when's the last time somebody rang the doorbell? Which, to be honest, I wouldn't do that. I would actually just fire up the app and figure that out.
Wait, let me make sure I completely understood what you said there. So you can't bring up the camera in the kitchen, and by the kitchen, do you mean you have a camera in the kitchen, or you have a device that you can't see the camera on? What did you mean by that? Did Joel go away? Hello?
The camera got him.
Oh, yeah, I got to remember to press push to talk.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was worried there for a minute. I'm like, did I freeze up?
I have a Google Home Hub, which is basically Google's version of the Echo Show. So it's Google, it works with the Google Home Assistant.
Right.
I can only talk to it and basically get, it won't actually show me the image on the front door. Not like the Echo Show will. So, when I'm not in my office, I'll just use my phone. Ain't no big deal. I always have my phone on me anyway. So if somebody rings the doorbell, I'll just pull my phone out and see who's there. And the nice thing is it also has a way that you can actually talk to the person that's standing on the porch, so you don't even have to open the door for the Jehovah's
Witness. Is that through the doorbell, too?
Yep, that's through the doorbell. There's a speaker in the doorbell. So there's a lot of stuff packed in that thing.
Okay, so I'm just curious. You already had a Google Home Hub, right?
Right.
It's in the kitchen. So why did you elect
the Why did I get the show?
Yeah.
Because
why did you get the show if they're not? Did you know beforehand that they weren't compatible with one another? And so
I did know that the basics is now Google has their Nest doorbell, same exact thing, except for it's all Google stuff.
Right.
And it works with the Home Hub. But there was a special on Black Friday where I got the doorbell was like 120 something, and an extra $10 they threw in the Echo Show, which is normally like $50 or $60. So I got that for like $10. That's the only reason I got it. But I figured it's not a big deal for me when I'm around the house, just, you know, look at my phone, because I'll have, like I said, have my phone around me all the time. But when I'm working, if I'm working and I don't want to pick up my phone, I can just glance over, and if they ring the doorbell, it should automatically come up on the display. So that way I don't even have to leave my desk to check it or even pick up my phone. I just glance over, and there it is right next to my work display. So, and there's really no compatibility between the two major doorbell kind of systems, the Nest and Nest is a little bit more friendly. I probably could get it to work on the Amazon devices, but I don't think there's like a universal one unless you like rolled your own or something like that. And these are cloud connected. So the nice thing about Ring is I think it's like $10 a month, and it'll store all the video on the cloud. A few other things. I think you also, as a Ring premium, you know, that's like their premium membership, I get like 10% off of other stuff in their store, because they sell other things too. Like they have other cameras and stuff too. Being there cloud connected, I will never have a cloud connected camera pointing all the time in the house. Like, for example, and this is kind of one thing I like about the Echo Show, is it does actually have a camera in it. You can actually use it for like phone call, like video calls through the Echo service. All right. But it has a physical switch that covers the camera. So it physically covers the camera when you flip the switch. So you won't ever have have to worry about the software not being truthful. So that's the only kind of cloud connected camera I'll have pointing inside the house. If I was going to set up cameras inside the house, I would set something up 100% where I have it and I own Root. So, and I wouldn't cloud connect internal cameras, and only the external cameras. External cameras, I don't care. Violate my neighbor's privacy, not mine.
Now, so just to be clear, though, you, when the doorbell rings, you can see who's at the door on your phone also, right?
Correct.
And can you see it on a computer through a web browser?
You can, through the ring.com website, you can. Okay. I haven't actually tried it in Linux. I bet you it would work. So, and actually, I won't have to start paying for the service until January. So, because they give you like 30-day trial.
Well, that's nice.
They also allow you. They also do a two-factor thing. So whenever you log into your Ring account, it will send you a text message.
Yeah. So do you like the text message sending, or do you prefer to like use Authenticator?
I'd rather if it actually used Authenticator myself.
Well, you didn't get a choice then, did you?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't let you. And yes, it does work in Linux. I'm actually looking out my front door now. I'm actually quite surprised at how well the camera works at night. It actually has pretty good night. Now, I will say this: it's dark out, and I can see. Like, we have wind chimes, bowling wind chimes that my son bought in Dallas last year.
Are they bowling pins?
Yeah, they got, okay. Like, some metal chimes in the bowling pins of the knockers, but it must have finally picked up live. So now I actually does have pretty good night vision. It's kind of grayish, you know, but it's functional. It's enough that I can see what's going on outside at night. Now, during the day, it's a nice 1080p color display. That'd be the only, like I said, this is the only kind of cloud-connected camera I would ever have, is one pointing externally out into public. But in several neighborhoods clear close by, and even our neighborhood, there's been people that would pilfer packages off the porch. That's not going to happen anymore. If it happens now, I'll be able to save the video, send it on to the various social networks like Nextdoor and stuff, and say, hey, be on the lookout. These guys stole something off my porch. And there you go. That's becoming a bigger problem nowadays with more people ordering stuff online and not going to the store to get their Christmas shopping done. I've done more Christmas shopping online in the last 2 years than I have ever. How about you guys? Do you do some shopping online?
You know what? Since I've been working from home, I don't remember ever going out shopping for Christmas. So I would have to say, yeah, I'm trying to remember the last time I actually went out to a store to go shopping for Christmas. And I remember, it was on my way home from work on December 23rd one year, or 24th or something. And I stopped at the Greenbrier Mall, which is right over there. That's the last time I remember going Christmas shopping. I don't even remember what year that was.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, a lot of things like actual Christmas shopping. Luke's got part of his present already, you know, with that bowling ball bag. But then I bought like some gift cards for my niece's. It was a triple pack of Starbucks cards. So I'll give each one of them a Starbucks card, and then the third one I'll give to Luke. And then I got Dad part of his. I'm standing there in line. I send a text to the wife and I say, so should I get Dad $50 for Texas Roadhouse or $25? I never heard, and it got to the point where she's ringing the card up. So I said, just give her $20. Give me $25. So I want to go get Dad a little bit more to go with that. I'll probably get him another gift card. Maybe not Texas Roadhouse, but that place is good, by the way. So if you've never ate there.
I've been to Texas Roadhouse.
Delicious. My favorite.
I've been there a while.
I don't get, you know, it's funny. I go there, I don't buy the biggest steak that I can get. I just get like a 6 ounce sirloin and their sides are pretty good too. So like I'll get like the mashed sweet potato or not mashed sweet potato, but a baked sweet potato. Usually I'll load it. But if I'm trying to be good, like last time I was trying to be good when we went out for my wife's birthday. So I got green beans and a Caesar salad with my steak. So I was a good monkey that day. I can't say anything about Thanksgiving, but you know.
Oh.
So, and then one more kind of, actually a couple little things I got. There's, we got one of them Tanger outlet malls, a little bit south of here, off of 71.
Wait, hold on a second.
Yeah.
What is it?
Tanger outlet mall.
How is that spelled?
T-A-N-G-E-R.
No, the reason why I ask is because I remember passing it. I thought it was Tangier Outlet Mall, but maybe it was a Tanger.
Probably was. They have more than one. I mean, they're not just in Ohio. So.
Oh, you know what? Okay, because I just thought, you know, for some reason I thought that was the name of the town. that I was passing through. I didn't realize that was like
it's a chain of outlet malls, essentially.
Okay, no, that makes sense. So
I went in there. There's a store in there called Kitchen Connection, and unfortunately the one down at ours is going out of business. So they're they got everything reduced down to like I think it was 40% off when I was down there. So we're walking through there, and they have these stacks of reconditioned or refurbed KitchenAid mixers, the one with the lifts on them, for $197, which is a crazy good deal. And my KitchenAid that I had, I've had one for 20 years, and it's still working. The one I got 20 years ago is still working. So... I'm sitting there. I said, boy, it'd be nice to pick that up for that good price. I don't know when it'll be that price again. And my wife, Misty, asked, well, what's the price of it? I said, it's $197. She's like, sold. I'm like, are you serious? She's like, yeah, go ahead, get it.
Wait, what did you buy?
It's the 6-quart KitchenAid mixer.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I saw that on.
With the lift.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. A MeWe.
I thought that's what you were talking about.
The red one, yeah. Yeah, and damn, that thing's nice. I love it. It's a great mixer. And it is better than the one without the lift. My old one's the old tilt back, which, like I said, still works. So one nice thing with that one, though, I've got it stuffed in a closet right now, but if I really get into a baking mode where I'm mixing two things at once, I could do that. Stand mixers. So... And then while I was there, I was channeling my LGR Foods. You ever watch that, Dan?
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's by Clint, who does Lazy Game Reviews, and he cooks food. And it's mostly sandwiches. So he'll have a bread, a cheese, and a meat, and some condiments like Duke's mayonnaise or something like that. And then what he always does with his cheese... is he'll put his cheese down over top of all the meat and stuff, and then he has a creme brulee torch, a butane torch that he'll melt the cheese with. So I started doing that because I got one down there. I got a butane. It's supposed to be like for making creme brulee, but it was like $12. So I'm like, dude. Everywhere else I've been looking at them, they're like $20 or $25. So I got one of those too. But I probably will learn teach myself how to make creme brulee at some point. I need to. But it's like, if you have one of those outlet stores, check for a Kitchen Connection. You might get some really good deals there. And then probably one of my other favorite stores in that outlet is they have a Pepperidge Farm outlet store, so I can go in there and get pretty much any kind of goldfish they make. The goldfish crackers, they have breads and cookies and crap like that. All sorts of carbs, the stuff we shouldn't eat. But that's kind of my shopping experiences on vacation for stuff I normally don't buy.
I ain't go nowhere.
Well, you went to your mother-in-law's.
Yeah, well, I didn't do any shopping, that's for sure. Well, I did get asked the technology question at and over Thanksgiving. So we were down in South Carolina and to visit my mother-in-law, and my sister-in-law was there with her husband and daughter, and also brother-in-law was there with his wife, and he. He hit me up with the question in that I will post it because he asked on Ask Ubuntu too, but he never got a response. And basically, in a nutshell, is what he wanted to do is he has a gateway or it's a logging, an Elk server for logging, for aggregating logs, and he has connections from his clients coming in to send the logs to the Elk server where he's aggregating them. Now, he has three separate connections that are coming in from different sources, different locations. And so he's got, so consider three different networks, all right? But they're two of them are private. Actually, I think three of them are, they're all private networks. So they're coming in from the internet into these private networks and then going to the Elk server. And some of those on the other side on that those branches are coming in from VPNs. So that's why he's I didn't ask why, but basically what he wanted to do is he has a situation where he needs the traffic coming in from whatever Ethernet connection, that Ethernet card, traffic coming from that card has to then go back out over that connection. It can't go out the default gateway because you can only have one default gateway, right? So any traffic, the problem he's having is, and he's trying different things, but any traffic that came over like Ethernet 2 need to go back out Ethernet 2 and not go out Ethernet 1. So traffic coming out.
A family member asked you this?
Yeah. So traffic coming in from Ethernet 2, what he was seeing was it would come in from Ethernet 2, but then go back out Ethernet 1. So he couldn't ping outside the network on Ethernet 2 when he sent ping requests through Ethernet 2 because the default gateway was Ethernet, was assigned to the route on Ethernet 1, right? So obviously, like, I haven't done a lot of networking in a while, so this was asked on Thursday. I asked Joe, right? And then I was like, the next day, I was like, I got to think about this some more. And I was really curious to see how to do it. And I figured there has to be the way to do it, but I just didn't know how to phrase the question. And when I asked Joe, I didn't know how to phrase the question. Other than posting his question. But what it seems to come down to is it's actually pretty simple. And so my first question is, so what he wanted to do is he wanted to set this up on Ubuntu 18.04, which is a long-term support, I believe, using IPNetPlan, which is Ubuntu's easy configuration extraction utility for setting up networking, where you don't have to get down and dirty with the IP table rules or whatever things that you want to do. There's easy things that you could do in NetPlan and set it up in like a YAML file, and it's pretty simple. So he said that I was like under the impression initially, like, okay, so NetPlan's not doing it for you. Can you do it without NetPlan? Have you done it before? And apparently this is the first time you're setting it up. So it's never done it before. So it wasn't a case of I had it working and now I have to switch to NetPlan and it's not working in NetPlan. So this is the first thing set up. Looking more into it, it sounds like what he needed to do is set up policy-based routing for the non-gateway interfaces. So in a sense, what you're going to do for policy-based routing is you define a route and you say, here is the route that I'm going to use for this policy, and you give it a name and you specify where it goes to, and the name is like whatever the routing table is going to be. So it gives it its own routing table. And then inside the routing table, instead of having a default gateway that applies to everything, you know, obviously it does apply to anything that is associated with that interface that's coming over that network, instead of looking at the default routing tables, they're going to look at the policies that you have set up, the routing policies for that specific network on that specific Ethernet or NIC adapter. And then in there you can specify like a default gateway to use instead of the regular, you know, standard default gateway that would be applied. So you apply that in there, and that's in that routing table. So I'm waiting to hear back if he if that solution worked for him. So keep my fingers crossed. But I post the question with my answer in the chat for the link to Ask Ubuntu. And that was an interesting question to have. And I don't know if Trolls got his microphone working. Did you get it working, Trolls?
Think so.
Oh, fantastic. Then you wanted to come and give us some information on ZFS, and I've been looking forward to this.
Well, first of all, good evening, guys.
Good evening, sir. Or good morning to you.
You could say that. Well, sorry I'm late. Basically, as with so many things in life, in regard to the microphone plug, I didn't put it in far enough. ...
Crazy.
But anyway, yeah, basically, I was wondering if any of you guys had been talking about a CFS in the year I had been gone.
No, I have not. I don't think any of us have used ZFS.
Really?
I did an installation of Ubuntu when the latest one came out, because you can now do an installation.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You had said you did it with ZFS in a container, though. Not in a container.
No, I haven't used it. Yeah, in a VM. I didn't use it for an extended period of time. I've since probably waxed that VM because my VMs don't typically stay around long.
Well, basically, that was kind of what I thought, because I've used CFS since 2011. It's one of my passions in terms of technology at this point. And actually, Dan, just adjusting to finish off the networking thing, that actually sounded quite familiar to me, because I actually do a very similar trick on FreeBSD.
What is it called on FreeBSD? Is it routing policies, or is it something else?
It's routing tables. That's basically a simple boot parameter you can specify, and then it, instead of just having a single routing table, it will come up with any number. Figure out to do whatever you want. For example, one thing I like to do on FreeBSD, I use FreeBSD jails for isolating various things.
You cut out a little bit there. You cut out for a minute. I didn't know if it was just me or for everybody.
Is that better?
Yeah. Well, hopefully.
Okay. We hope. Well, basically, one thing I like to do on FreeBSD is when I run jails, I like to give each jail its own interface, so I can specify a separate VLAN or a separate default gateway for it. And basically what I do is I give each jail its own routing table, and I can do whatever I want. So it's so that's what I use multiple routing tables for. It's really useful. So it sounded quite familiar to what you were describing in terms of directing network traffic around.
That is interesting. So now that's jails on FreeBSD, and so each one has its own. Each jail has its own routing table applied to it, or
basically that's one way to do the networking. There's a lot of more fancy ways, but I like to do it this way because it's really simple.
Okay.
Basically, FreeBSD has this new feature. It has had it for a while. That's called network stack virtualization, where you can basically have an entire network stack for a jail. And other such things. They have a bunch of cool tricks you can do with networking. But I wanted to talk about, as I told you, I wanted to talk about ZFS, because I was kind of guessed that maybe you guys hadn't looked into it that much.
Well, hold on 1 second. Before you start talking about it, just to step back a second, you said you've been running ZFS since 2010? 2011. And so has it been strictly on FreeBSD, or have you been running it on SUSE too?
Only on FreeBSD since then. Okay. I actually have a whole set of notes here where I will go through all that stuff.
Okay.
So you guys, how familiar are you with CFS in general?
I'm somewhat familiar with it. I have never actually used it, but I have listened to people talking about using it. I've read some about it, but I've never physically used it myself.
I see. What about the rest of you?
Joel used it on a...
very limited use.
Install.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, I was thinking more about like how much you know about it, like how familiar are you with it in terms of, you know, just in principle.
I know. You know, the basics of it, and that's about all I know. I know that you can span it across drives and all that stuff. You can have a, you can revert back to earlier points in time and things like that.
All right, basically, I didn't want here to come on here and give a course if, say, if one of you had like been using it for years. So
right.
That's good to know. So, you know, just wanted to, you know, set that up. But okay. Let's see here. Well, get my notes here. Well, basically, the one of the first things that people think when I say CFS is that people hear the name and they think it's just, you know, a file system. But it really is actually quite a lot more than that, because, you know, you think XFS, it's a file system, you think CFS, it's a file system, but CFS is actually an entire platform almost for managing storage, because it rolls together a file system, a volume manager, and software RAID into one integrated stack, and that gives you lots of advantages. That because the different layers kind of know what each other is doing and it can rely on each other for information about what's actually going on. Whereas if you layer something like ext4 on top of like an LVM, they don't really know what to do with each other, except that it's a block device that can read and write.
There's separate processes that would be involved in dealing with either one of those two, but not both, correct?
Exactly.
Whereas ZFS integrates it all together into a platform.
Yeah. That's how I like to think of it, because it's just astonishing what it can do at this point. But just to, you know, step back a bit, it was originally, as you guys probably know, but some people might not know it, it was originally developed by Sun Microsystems, and it was actually originally released for Solaris all the way back in 2005. And then a few years later, after that, I think around 2007 or 8, it was actually ported to FreeBSD. And then it eventually became a permanent feature of FreeBSD in 2009 when it was no longer experimental. And one of the reasons it took so long for it to come to Linux is because of some licensing issues. Basically, when Sun open sourced Solaris, they chose to write their own license, which is, they call the CDDL. And that license is basically incompatible with the GNU GPL. So you can't really easily mix code from Solaris into Linux, and that, you know, there was a lot of, you know, rumors going around that it was specifically to prevent that. But, you know, basically the difference between the GPL and the CDDL is that they're both kind of copyleft licenses, but the GPL says, okay, you take one bit from a program, and then you make changes to it, and then you have to release your entire version as a GPL as well, whereas in with the CDDL, it basically says that specific part of the program you modify, that you have to release. And so it's a kind of softer copyleft, but it's kind of, it created a problem there. So basically what some people did initially was to use the Fuse framework to enable CFS on Linux, but that didn't really take off much. But then a few years later, some people started to actually port it to Linux and kind of get around the licensing issues by using stuff like DKMS, so that you didn't have to distribute binaries. And then eventually people started to get sort of like, you know, kind of, you know, shoving it under the carpet and kind of trying to, you know, ignore the licensing issues. And basically that's why some of the Linux kernel developers are still a little bit grumpy about it. Because they still sort of associate CFS with Sun, even.
And
though,
I remember that.
Yeah. I think Greg Crow Hartman is one of those that's still grumpy about it. But basically, it's actually really interesting because since Oracle bought Sun, they shut down Open Solaris, so Solaris is no longer open source. But then what happened, of course, is that people took the last open source version of CFS and forked it, and now that fork is, which is called OpenCFS, is about 10 times better than what Oracle does, obviously, right? So yeah, that was, so that's the reason why that it, CFS started on Solaris, then relatively quickly came to FreeBSD, and that's when I started using it, because I, you know, I'm pretty paranoid about storage in general, and then just say I just used it on FreeBSD, but now it's available on Linux as well, and it's, I wouldn't say it's you know, completely straightforward to use on Linux because of the licensing issues, but it's not too hard either. So it's, but I'll get into that. So that's basically where CFS comes from Sun Microsystems, and so some reasons why someone might want to use it. I mentioned I'm pretty paranoid about storage because basically I think close to, I think 19 years ago or something, I had been building a web page, and then I had sort of like a disastrous partition failure or something, and then lost the whole thing, and that was really annoying. So ever since, I've been rather paranoid about my storage being reliable. And so when I first started hearing about CFS, it was like, man, this sounds really good, because one of the things it really focuses on is end-to-end data integrity, where in almost no situation, on short of a, you know, complete catastrophic hardware failure where like a motherboard fails or something like that, no data will essentially become corrupt, either because of bad hard drives or, you know, bad cables or anything like that. And it basically does this, you know, it does it in a number of ways, but to mention some that are easy to understand. The first one is that, in contrast to sort of the traditional file systems that we all know, CFS is designed around what's called a copy-on-write model, which basically means that when some data is changed, instead of overwriting that original data, it will write the data to a new location on disk and then change the metadata that points to it once it's done. Which means that if you have, say, a power outage or an OS crash or something like that, you either have the old version or you have the new version, and not some sort of halfway house that leaves the file system in an inconsistent state, which is why CFS doesn't have FSCK or anything like that. It's just always consistent on disk. And then it also uses checksums for pretty much everything it does. So for example, when you save some data, like say a file, it will, all the blocks that underpins that file, it will do a checksum of each of the blocks and then save the data and store the checksums as part of its metadata. So when you go back to read the data later, it can tell whether the disk gave it the correct data. So you don't avoid this issue of having hard drives giving you bad data. So for example, if you have a mirror, like a RAID 1, if one of the disks gives you the wrong data, either because it just gave you the wrong one or it had a bad sector or something, CFS will know that it's getting bad data. So instead of handing bad data to the application, it will just say, hey, you gave me the wrong data, and then go and fetch it from some other location and then give that to the application. And once that's done, it will try to repair the original one. So it sort of heals itself. And that can either be from a mirror or it can be from a parity RAID. So basically, if you a disk failure will or some sort of like a disk that's starting to fail won't crash your database or something like that. Even worse, crash your encryption. So it's and that's some. I remember like 10 years ago, I was so paranoid about some of my video files going bad on hard drives that I would like make an MD5 checksum of pretty much all my stuff, so I could like once a month check whether, you know, any of my stuff had gone bad. But now CFS does that for me, so I don't have to worry about that. And there are other features like this that gets around all sorts of hardware bugs and other really crappy things about stored technologies.
How far back
does it go for you? I would assume it's configurable, but how far back are changes preserved?
Well, actually, you're kind of mixing together two things here, because this what I'm talking about is basically the basis of how it works, and what you're talking about is snapshots.
Right. So you're going to get to that. I'm sorry. I jumped the gun there.
No problem. But so if someone is really interested in having a data integrity focused system where you can reliably say whenever you ask the system to give you some of the data that's stored, you will actually always get the correct data. That's a really good reason to use ZFS, because it just always does that. Another reason you might want to use it is because it's actually designed to make the job of the storage admin easy. Because if you look at some of the utilities and frameworks for storing data, like LVM and all this stuff, more often than not, it's like a collection of commands, and you have to think about, like, I think with LVM is like two or three, and then you have like whatever, for ext4, it's like, what's like mkfs2 e2 or various things like that, fsck obviously, like almost like a handful of utilities you really have to wrap your mind around. And then it obviously grows when you have XFS and you have all these other ones. Whereas with CFS, it's just two straightforward, easy to understand commands. One of them is called cpool, which basically administers your storage array, or your storage pool as it's called, where you basically put all your disks in, and then you thin provision file systems or data sets, as it's called, on top of those. Because file systems, or data sets, as CFS calls them, they're basically small bits of metadata. So it basically treats your storage as kind of like a database almost. And kind of lost my train of thought there. But it's basically designed to make things a lot easier to manage. And so basically, these two commands that you use, you can basically just skim, use like 20 seconds to look through the man page, and you can wrap your head around it in mere minutes. Whereas I remember one time when I had to try to use LVM, I had to spend like 15 minutes looking through the man page and articles on forums and stuff. That was just a pain. Whereas with CFS, it's just straightforward with, simple command line arguments that are almost like words that you spell out, as opposed to like archaic command line parameters. There's actually a good story about this, and one of the reasons that Sun ended up creating CFS was because there's a good story back from the 90s that there was like some storage administrator that had mistyped a command into the Solaris volume manager, and then the whole company just like crashed because the whole thing just came down. And then there was like some people who sat there for hours waiting for the thing to get back up, and they were like, why can't we just make a new file system? And eventually they did. So that was I'm sure we all have stories like that. So, but also, what some people will, when I talk about ZFS, one of the common things I hear is that, what about, like BTRFS or any of these newer things? Basically, one word answers to that: reliability. Because Sun started developing ZFS back in like the year 2000, and it was released as a production ready file system in 2005. So it's basically been out there working in real life for 14 straight years. They stood the test of time, and Sun put an enormous amount of engineering resources into it. And when you use it, you can really tell, because it's really, really polished. Everything just works, which is, you know, more than you can say about, say, the RAID 5 functionality in BTRFS. And basically, you know, one of the people who started BTRFS and was heavily involved in this was Red Hat, and they bailed on it because they just thought it was, you know, a waste of time. So that was an interesting thing. Also, just to mention some, you know, I mentioned that whole thing about CFS being an integrated stack of, you know, file system, volume manager, and RAID. And this has some pretty significant advantages. For example, when you use, say, Linux software RAID or a hardware RAID controller, then on top of that, you put your file system, whether it's XFS or EXT4 or whatever. And then once you have a disk failure, what the RAID has to do is it can't really, it has no way to look at the file system because, as you said, Dan, it's a separate, almost like a separate domain, so to speak. So you might have data on your drives that were actually deleted 6 months ago, but was never overwritten with new live data. So a hardware RAID controller, what it will do when you ask it to restore a disk, whether it's in a RAID 1 mirror or whether it's a parity RAID 5 or RAID 6, it will just restore everything blindly. So you can have it sitting there restoring, you know, hundreds of gigabytes that are just, you know, cruft on the disk. That's not actually any files that you have on your file system. Whereas with CFS, because it has, you know, an integrated view of both the disks and also the file system, it can say, well, this data I have here is the one that's actually live, whereas this other stuff is stuff that I freed 6 months ago that I no longer need. So it will only restore what's actually there, as opposed to, you know, restoring what's essentially a recycle bin. And that can save you a whole bunch of time when you have to restore a really large array where the data changes often, for example, like a database or something like that. And now I'm actually going to get to what you mentioned, Dan, and that would be snapshots, because like most other file system or volume managers, CFS can do snapshots. But it has something else. It has a built-in replication feature called send and receive. And what this does is that it will take a snapshot and turn it into like a stream, a data stream, which can be sent through a Unix pipe. So you can basically replicate an entire snapshot from one storage pool to another or to another system by sending it over the network through SSH, through a Unix pipe. And this has some huge advantages over something like rsync, because rsync works at the file and block layer, where it will, if you have, like, say you sync one folder to another, rsync basically have to walk through the folders and figure out what the differences are. And that, if you have a lot of small files or you just have some really large folder structures, that can take a long time. I remember one FreeBSD developer telling a story about using rsync to replicate like the FreeBSD's developers' home directories, and it took like 24 hours before it even started copying data because it has spent so much time figuring out what the differences were. Whereas with CFS, once you have the initial replication the starting point, so to speak, it knows internally what the differences between two snapshots are. It doesn't have to go looking through things. It can just say, you know, the difference between yesterday and today, it has sort of its own time internally, so to speak. So it can just basically start sending the data right away. So instead of spending like an hour for a really huge amount of data with rsync, you could just start sending the data over the network right away. And if you have, say, it's a local network over 10 gigabit Ethernet, that can go really fast. And you get your backup job done much quicker. And you can also send like a CFS send stream. You can pipe it to a file and save it on tape, or you can, you know, do lots of other things to it. And CFS also has built-in compression, and you can choose between like GZIP. You can choose to use the faster LSET4, the working on integrating set standard, and all sorts of new compression algorithms. And it actually also recently has gotten encryption support. So it will also have built-in encryption, which you can administer using the same simple command line interfaces that I mentioned earlier. Instead of having to, you know, do ext4, then lux, then, you know, MDADM, maybe LVM as well. It's just all baked into one one integrated stack that's easy to deal with. So that's basically why I think people should consider ZFS. There are some good reasons to use it.
And you have not used ZFX on Linux, right?
Actually, I do. One of my company servers, I have a VM host, which is that runs Debian. And I actually use ZFS on that. And it actually works surprisingly well. I was actually really surprised because when I first tried it, I was like, I wonder if this is actually completely ready. But it turned out it was. They had actually done a really good job of porting it. So let's say someone listening here found what I just rambled on about really interesting and they want to take a look at CFS. So how do you use it? Well, let's see. The easiest way, especially if you want to have, you know, have the OS installed on CFS, which is called like root on CFS, easiest way is obviously to use an operating system that has it baked in. And that would, for example, be Ubuntu or FreeBSD. That would be the two main ones where it's, you know, integrated in officially. FreeBSD has had it since like 2009, as I said. So it's, you know, available right in the installer. It takes 5 minutes to install FreeBSD with ZFS. It's actually really easy to install. It's if you can install something like Debian with the text interface, the text installer, you can install FreeBSD even easier than that. That would be one way to do it. I think one of you mentioned that that Ubuntu has an experimental installer that can install CFS. That would also be one way. And then there's also, if it's not important to have the OS installed on CFS, but just, you know, have, you know, your storage array, you can also just install the packages for it. Most distributions have packages for it in their community repositories. That will obviously add the kernel module for it, so you can, and the command lines. And that would be the two easiest ways. If you are into more of a challenge, you can also use Debian, because Debian includes CFS in their contrib repository as a DKMS package. Now, for people who don't know, DKMS is basically a way to package kernel modules as source files, so that whenever there's a kernel update, it will recompile the kernel module automatically. And this is basically a way for Debian to get around the licensing issues, because you can easily redistribute CFS as source code, but you can't compile it as a binary. That's where it gets into GPL issues, so that's why Debian includes it as a DKMS package. But actually, so if you already have an existing Debian system, you can just install that and you have CFS available. But if you want to install Debian onto CFS, you basically have to install Debian in a kind of similar way to how you would install Gentoo, where you take a live CD and basically do the whole thing manually. if you guys can imagine that.
I can imagine it.
It's actually not so bad. That's actually what I did. And I actually basically just put up a Debian Live CD, install free CFS in the live environment, and then eventually you just partition your disks and get the CFS root pool, and eventually you just run the command D bootstrap to that. And then there's obviously a bunch of other things you have to do, but that's another way to do it. And that's what I like to do. I actually did an install of it just yesterday. So for a friend. So it worked out. And the version of CFS that's included with Debian 10 is actually really, really stable. So I could recommend that. So that's basically how somebody would go about using it. And it's also, if you guys are familiar with FreeNAS.
Yeah, I'm familiar with FreeNAS.
FreeNAS is based on FreeBSD, and it has CFS as one of its main features. So that would be another way if you want to have a dedicated NAS box with CFS. But just install FreeNAS. And that's really, really easy because that has, you know, a web GUI and all that stuff for it. So. But actually, one interesting thing, I mentioned that CFS arrived late for Linux because of the licensing issues.
Right.
It's actually been really interesting because the way it happened originally was that FreeBSD ported the code from Solaris, because, you know, Solaris and FreeBSD share some history in terms of the source code. So it was not easy, but simpler for them to take the code from Solaris and port it to FreeBSD. And basically, the way it was ported to FreeBSD was that they made sort of a Solaris compatibility layer that translates Solaris system calls into FreeBSD. And that way they didn't have to rewrite whole swaths of it. And basically, Linux people who ported to Linux did the same thing, created sort of a Solaris portability layer, and then use that. And what was turned out to be really interesting was that originally FreeBSD was obviously ahead because they got CFS back in 2008. But what happened some years ago was that the Linux version started getting new features, really interesting features, quicker than the FreeBSD version. And eventually the Linux version and the FreeBSD port of CFS started to diverge so that it was harder for them to bring features between them. And what the FreeBSD guys decided to do about, I think, a year and a half ago or something like that, was to basically adopt the Linux port of ZFS and just sort of report it to FreeBSD by adding the compatibility bits. So now they basically are starting to share the whole code base, which will be really interesting because now they will have the same features and there will be more eyes looking at it. So better. I think that was really interesting. So CFS has basically become the first, you know, file system between Linux and the BSDs that's sort of completely functional. Because if any of you guys have tried to use FreeBSD and Linux together, you'll know that FreeBSD's support for, say, EXT3 is not particularly great. Or Linux support for UFS is not particularly great either. UFS states. So you can literally move. You could actually literally install Linux and FreeBSD on the same pool. Just have it in different data sets. Which is an interesting thought. That was developments.
How easy is it, like, say you have a hard drive failing, right? How easy is it to replace the hard drive?
Oh, it's really easy, actually. It just takes, it depends a little bit on how, let's say the drive fails entirely, so like it just disappears from the system. Then you basically take it out, stick in a new hard drive, and then run a single command, and it starts to replace it.
And so, that okay. So if you had, well, how many drives do you need on the system?
But that depends.
Would you say, like, do you do that kind of recovery? Have you had that? Do you do raid on your?
Yeah. Basically, there are several ways you can do. CFS can do, you know, it can do a single disk, and that obviously has its disadvantages that it's just a single disk. But it can also do like a mirror, which would be RAID 1. It can also do what's called RAID Z, which is parity RAID, like RAID 5 and 6. And then it also it can actually do something that doesn't exist anywhere, where you know RAID 5 that has one parity drive and RAID 6 has two, right? It can actually do a sort of parity RAID that has three parity drives, which you can maybe call like RAID 7, but which doesn't exist anywhere. It's only CFS that has this, and which is really nice for like really really huge hard drives. Like I think Seagate just announced that the next year they will be shipping 20 terabyte hard drives, which is, you know, mind blowing. So, but basically, if you just wanted to have like a mirror for the system drive, or just, you know, for a single volume, then you obviously only need two drives. If you want to do RAID 5, or which is called RAID Z1, you would need three drives at least. And if you want to do RAID 6 or RAID Z2, as it's called, you would need four drives at least. And then upwards from there. So, so basically, for example, I like to, for some of my customers, I've built small NAS boxes. And those basically have two SSDs internally for the system drive, and then they have four hard drives. And then so for a box like that, you could either do, you know, RAID set one if you had small drives with, you know, one parity drive and three storage disks, or you could do RAID 6 and have two storage disks and two parity disks. It depends on how paranoid you are. But basically, if you to replace a drive, all you do is either if a drive is entirely dead, so it just disappeared, you just put a new one in, or if it's still there but, you know, giving read errors, you just basically say, like, the command is like zpool offline the drive name, and then, you know, there's like zpool replace the drive name, and then it's on its merry way. And you don't need to, you know, do all sorts of fancy things. You don't need to resize any file systems. You don't need to, you know, unmount anything. It just works. So it's really simple that way. If any of you have used LVM and ever been frustrated with it for any reason, you should definitely check out CFS. It's so much easier to deal with, even despite the licensing problems.
I'm trying to think. I think I had to use LVM through Chef. Yeah, I know. We had, oh my goodness. I'm trying to remember how this went. So we had this MapR implementation that we had to do, where we had to a lot of AWS storage attached together to create, like, it was like over a terabyte or something of storage that ended up being on this thing. And I believe we had to use I don't remember. It was so long ago. It was like 3 or 4 years ago that we did this.
Mm. So you basically used it to sort of stripe things together?
No, well, there was like a limit on the, there's a limit on how much storage we could get or something to do with that. And so it needed to be presented as one volume, so we used I used LVM through Chef, and it was a pain in the butt because I had to write all these scripts to bring it all together, because again, when we were doing the Chef stuff, it's trying to make a stateful situation out of a non-stateful tool.
That sounds like a mess.
So it actually worked, and they used it for a while. But it was a proprietary kind of software that we had to get. So we worked with the company to do the Chef cookbooks and get that stuff all pulled together. But mm-hmm. I don't even it's not in use anymore. It was an expensive thing that we had to get working. I can
imagine. Well, basically, and that's another thing. Speaking of price, another good thing about CFS is that it's open source, free software. So it's just you can use it on anything, like the most basic. You know, you can use it on a 10-year-old, you know, desktop motherboard with, you know, 6 SATA ports, or you can use it on, you know, a super high-end storage server from Supermicro or IBM or something like that. For example, I have a server in my company. It has like, I think it's like 3 chassis that can hold up to 48 drives, and then it has 9 drives at the moment. And that's actually, speaking of that, one thing CFS also makes really easy is upgrading. So for example, let's say you have a small NAS, just as a simple example, and you have, say, 3 terabyte drives. Now, if you're running something like EXT4 on that, or, you know, Software RAID or whatever, upgrading that can be a real pain in the ass, depending on how sophisticated you are as an administrator, or how sophisticated the NAS is, whether it's, you know, like a branded Western Digital NAS, or it's, you know, a hardware RAID controller that can do something fancy. In any case, it's usually bit of a challenge to upgrade that thing, because you have to, you know, really hope that things go well. But with CFS, the thing you can do with a small NAS like that is you can just, you know, replace each of the drives one by one by using the RAID restoration feature or functions, so that you pretend one of the drives is dead, and you just, you know, offline it, take it off the system, put a bigger drive in, let it restore the data, and then do the next thing for the next drive. And then once all the drives are replaced, it just says, hey, all the drives are bigger, there's more storage here. And you don't have to move anything, you don't have to, you know, resize anything. It's just there, and it just works. That's what you can do with a small NAS, where you don't necessarily have the ability to add more drives. But if you do, say you have a system that can take 8 hard drives, and you have 4 at the moment, then another way to upgrade is to basically add an additional 4 drives in a separate array. So Dan, are you familiar with the RAID features called RAID 50 and RAID 6?
No, I don't do much with RAID personally, so I am not very familiar.
No, we're all working with cloud stuff, so we don't even have access to hardware 90 times out of 10.
Fair enough. But you guys are familiar with RAID 0, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, striping, like 2 disks. Basically, RAID 50 is a technique where you take 2 RAID 5 arrays and like create and use like RAID 0 on top of them. So instead of having 2 bare disks strapped together as one, you take 2 sets of disks and stripe them together. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's what you can do with CFS, because a CFS pool is basically, it has the drives are grouped together in what's called virtual devices. And the virtual devices can either be a mirror or a parity RAID of some sort. And then you can basically add virtual devices to a pool. So like, let's say I have a virtual device, a single one, in a pool that's, you know, 4 drives wide. Then I could choose to add another one that's 4 drives wide, and so on. So for example, in my company servers, say in one of my Nextcloud servers, It can take 24 drives at the moment, and at the moment it has 6. So whenever those drives, you know, get more data stored on them, it can just add another 6 drives, and then once those are full, then another 6 drives, and so on, without doing all sorts of fancy stuff. It's just add another one. It's just a single command to do it. Beautiful.
That is nice. What's the largest set of hard drives or whatever you want to call it that you've worked with?
For me personally, I think the largest array I have is like in my rack, it's like 9-8 terabyte drives.
Jeez.
And I run that in what's called RAID set 3. So basically 3 of those drives are parity drives. And so that I get the storage capacity of the 6, which means that 3 drives can fail without me losing data, which is really nice. And obviously, this is something people often forget. The great thing about having a software RAID as opposed to hardware RAID, because let's say you have a 16 or 8 drive controller, you know, that hardware RAID controller can only deal with the drives it has attached for obvious reasons. There are some really fancy RAID controllers some years ago that could sort of like span 2 controllers together, but it was like buggy and quite an expensive feature. Because that's one thing about hardware RAID. It's always very expensive, pretty much.
Right.
Whereas with software RAID, you can obviously take multiple disk controllers and create a software RAID array that spans those controllers. So, for example, in my private CFS server, I have it's a box that I built back in 2012, and it can take 48 hard drives, and it has 3 16-port disk controllers, HBA controllers. And basically what I do is I have 1 drive for each controller. So like, for example, if I have a 3 drive array, each of those will be on a separate controller, so I can have an entire controller fail without me losing data, because the drives are distributed evenly across the controllers. So if an entire disk controller fails, no problem. Each of the arrays just lose precisely the number of drives that they're able to lose without data loss. That can make your systems even more resilient by getting rid of hardware RAID. And obviously, one thing I really loathe about hardware RAID is that, you know, it's entirely proprietary. So once the manufacturer starts fixing bugs in their firmware, well, you might run into a catastrophic bug years later. Whereas with CFS, it's just open source software, and if there's a problem, you can dig your hands in if you have to. Or some other people can do so for you. We all know it's a great thing. And then another thing 3CFS does really well is it has really expansive caching functionality. So for example, I run some Nextcloud servers. And one thing Nextcloud always recommends is that you use a PHP caching to speed it up. But I don't do that because CFS does that for me. It basically caches all that, both the application data and the actual content data, and then I don't have to do all sorts of PHP caching, which, you know, saves me a bunch of hassle.
It caches it in memory.
Yeah, basically CFS has like an entire pyramid of caching. Basically, as I think I mentioned earlier, it sort of treats storage as like a database.
Right.
But because of the copy on write model, it basically does these transactions where it sort of flushes the data to disk every 5 seconds, or you can also change it to be longer. So what it will do is that it has something called the CFS intent log, which is like sort of like a memory cache that it always has, and then you can add an SSD to have it, you know. For example, let's say you are running a 10 gigabit Ethernet, but your hard drives can't do 10 gigabit. Then you could have an SSD that could do 10 gigabit, so that when you send data at 10 gigabits to the server, it will first use its RAM cache, then once that fills up, then it will dump it down to SSD so that it can say, okay, I got it, to the application, like Samba or something like that. And then eventually, after 5 seconds, it flushes the whole thing to disk in a really efficient way. So whereas with EXT4, it would start writing to the disk immediately. CFS, adding an SSD cache to CFS is also like one or two commands.
So how much overhead does that put on to the server, and or if you're using it as a desktop and using ZFS as your file system, how much overhead does that add on the system? And, you know, is it something that you need to throw more RAM at when you're considering
basically use of CFS, ZFS? Basically, CFS loves RAM. Let's put it like that.
Right.
And but basically, the rule of thumb is you to use it reliably, you need at least 8 gigs of RAM. And if you can use it with 4 gigs, but you need to tune it a bit for that. But, you know, it's if we look at resources, a good hardware RAID controller costs like several hundred dollars, whereas like an 8 gig RAM stick, it's like, what, $10? So, I think I have an almost 10-year-old Lenovo ThinkPad has 16 gigabytes of RAM. So basically, CFS likes RAM. It's not really that CPU intensive at all. It's basically just likes RAM. But the overhead is actually not that bad. If you want, obviously, a 64-bit CPU, because 32-bit is a bit, it doesn't really work so well on 32-bit. But I would guess all of us run 64-bit at this point. So if you have a 64-bit CPU and 8 gigs of RAM, it's basically you actually only notice that it's really fast because of the RAM caching. So it's not really all that bad. I have my own personal storage box is an Opteron CPU from 2010 or something like that. Works perfectly. So it's not really, and actually CFS also does some interesting things. For example, as I said, it has built-in compression. So for example, it will compress the data before it's get written to disk, and then when it reads it off the disk, then it will obviously decompress it. Now you might think that would make it slower, but it can actually make it faster. Which, you know, sounds a little counterintuitive, right? But the reason for that is if you have a hard drive, say you have a hard drive that can do, you know, 80 megabytes a second or something like that. If you have to write, say, 800 megabytes, that will obviously take 10 seconds. But if you can compress that data down to like half of it or like, you know, 2/3 of it, whatever, and you can do it at a compression speed that's faster than a hard drive, then you basically have to write half the data to the hard drive, and then it's twice as fast. So, and that's especially good for databases, because databases are mostly text. So, for example, on my Nextcloud server, I have compression activated for the database MySQL folder, and it basically compresses it down like maybe to 1/3, which is less wear on the SSD I used, and it's also faster.
So yeah, I'm wondering where the cutoff point is there. I mean, that sounds like it would be good for large files in particular, but how beneficial is it for small, like if you have a lot of small files?
Depends on what kind of files it is. For example, video files, they don't compress very well because they're already compressed. But if it's like a, you know, say you have a really large email archive.
Uh-huh.
If you have inbox files, you know, the big mail files, right?
Right.
Those would compress really well.
I can see that, yeah.
And it also depends a little bit how. Another thing that's basically the good thing is you can tune every individual data set to your particular needs. So, for example, if you have an archive, and the goal is just to compress it as much as possible, so it takes as built disk space as possible, because you just have to archive things and not read it all the time, you could use gzip, which really is slow, but it will compress it, you know, further down. And you can also tune. You can even tune the block size. So like the default for CFS is it stores 128 kilobyte blocks, but you can also make it smaller, you can make it larger depending on the application you have. For example, MySQL writes 16 kilobyte blocks by default, so you can adjust that down to match it if you wanted to. There's lots of ways to use it.
When, oh man, I just had a question I was going to ask.
Sure.
Oh, crap. I don't know if it was... I think it was about the compression stuff still. It popped in my mind, and then I got distracted, and I lost it. Damn it. Oh, wow.
Performance? Ability?
Damn, I forgot what it was. The damn cat distracted me. I was like... Because I was listening to what you were saying. I'm like... I thought I had another some more questions about the compression... But no, I know what it was. Okay, so it sounded like when you were talking about it, you said you had compression on your database, and
yep.
So it sounded like you said you had it on the directory where your database files were. Can you get that granular with ZFS that you could apply it down at like directory structures, or is it more or less on partition boundaries?
Basically, as I said, that CFS doesn't have partitions.
Right.
It's because what we call data sets is basically like, think of like an EXT4 partition, but like at a thin provision where it's not an actual partition or an actual file system in that sense. It's just a little bit of metadata in the entire storage pool. Because basically underneath the way CFS works internally, it's actually more like an object store. So the files and folders is actually just an abstraction. It's not physical files and folders. That's just the way it presents it. It's like a top layer. And you can create several billion data sets per pool you can create or something like that. So you could create, say you have like a server with a lot of home directories. You could have a CFS data set for each user's home directory, or you could have for example, let's say the MySQL folder, it usually has a binary log, and then it has the tables. So you could say the binary log is stored with 128 kilobyte blocks, and the actual data files is stored with, you know, like 16k blocks. So you could have a data set for every single folder that you might want to treat differently or have different settings for, different permissions on, whatever the case may be. You can really get down, and it's not hard at all. So for example, as one of the FreeBSD developers, I've been working on integrating a newer compression algorithm called, it was actually developed by Facebook, it's called a set standard or a C standard, whatever you want to pronounce it. And what that does is that it gives compression levels similar to gzip, but at much higher speed. So you could say maybe, On log files, you could do set standard. On your database, you could do LSET4. So you can basically create these ZFS data sets and have one of them mounted on a specific folder, and you can tune that data set for whatever you're storing in that folder. For example, Netflix developed a feature called large blocks, where you can have the data stored in 1 megabyte blocks, which Netflix found was really efficient for their streaming services, so that it would read a block at the time sequentially off the disk. So you can really get really granular, to say the least.
That's cool.
It's awesome, actually. It's and as I was said, one thing they had been working on for like I think around 4 years or so is baked in encryption. So instead of having to do like what FreeBSD had been doing for years is that they had been using their sort of native encryption, so that you would create the encryption framework first and then layer CFS on top of that. But now they have baked in encryption into CFS, so you can just do like, I think I haven't tried it because it's still a little bit it's really new feature. So it's basically like CFS set encryption on, and then you generate some keys, and then you can mount the thing. And what's really useful is actually they found a way so that it will store a checksum both for the encrypted data and for the decrypted data, so that you could have the encrypted data, you know, locked, whereas but the storage administrator can still do what he does, you know, perform maintenance and, you know, background scrub the pools to make sure all the data is intact. And then you can even replicate the encrypted data to an offsite location without decrypting it. So it's also an end-to-end encryption engine. Now that's cool.
Yeah, that is really nifty.
So for example, let's say you have like an offsite location where you don't trust the people there to actually not look at your data, then you can replicate your data to that location, the encrypted version of the data, and then, you know, not care what happened to it. That's neat.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. You know what? We got to wrap this up, but I really appreciate you coming on and talking about ZFS.
Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
And so this is available for anybody to use now. It's depending on your distribution, it might be different ways to get it. It's probably included. You could just pull it in there. I don't know how easy it is to do an install.
Actually, it's probably not included except for, as I said, it's included in Ubuntu and in Debian. Which
isn't it in Red Hat too?
Oh, definitely not. But it's available. You can just download the packages. If you just go to zfsonlinux.org, you can find RPM packages for a lot of distributions there. Or if you look in the community repositories of most of the distributions, like for example for OpenSUSE, you can just look at the OpenSUSE build service, and there'll be CFS packages there. Or I don't know, you know, Arch Linux, it probably has, you know, packages for it, and it's not hard to find. It's not hard to find. It's more a little bit of a challenge if you want to actually install your system onto CFS. Then you might want to look at either Linux user, you might want to look at Debian, or you might want to look at.
Yeah. So did you say ZFS on Linux.org? Did you say that? Right?
Yeah. Literally, yeah. ZFS on Linux.org.
Yeah. And because you get there. Yeah, just pretty much right there. So you got getting started for Arch, Debian, Fedora, Gentoo, OpenSUSE, RHEL, and CentOS, and Ubuntu. And if I'm not mistaken, like OpenSUSE, they've had ZFS available in OpenSUSE for a really long time, haven't they?
No, actually, they standardized on BTRFS some years ago for some reason.
Oh, was that? What was the distribution that had ZFS? You know, for it's been in there for a while. I thought it was OpenSUSE or SUSE Enterprise Linux that had.
Yes, I can't recall anyone that included. Maybe some little obscure, you know, fork of something. I could imagine that, but none of the big ones do it because, as I said, there's a complication.
Yeah, I know. It's a complication with
the GPL. Yeah. So, but it's, you know, it's. My approach to this is open source software, and so, you know, as I said, it's easy to find. And if you want to install FreeBSD, well, it's easy. It takes 5 minutes.
What version of... Do you just use straight FreeBSD, or do you use one of the spins of FreeBSD?
Yeah, I use straight FreeBSD. That's okay. It's right in the installer. You basically... when you get to the partitioning settings, you can choose root on ZFS, and then it will ask you like which drive or drives do you want to install it on. And then if you have a single drive, it will just do it there. And if you have multiple drives, it will ask you, do you want to create a mirror? And then you select the two drives, and then it just goes ahead and does that. And actually, one thing that's really cool, if you install it on a single drive, you can actually add a second drive and turn it into a mirror later.
There we go.
There you go.
So hey, everybody, Joel B., you installing ZFS as we right after we get off the show here.
I think he's going to
that. I think I'm going to...
Yeah.
I don't know what I'm going to do. Not that. See, you know, I'm to the age now where, yeah, I still like to mess with some techie things, but doing server shit, you know, I do it all fucking day. I don't want to do it anymore. In at night.
How old are you, actually, man? Is that what
I
ask?
I am 48, dude.
Yeah, I can see that.
Wow, you're old.
Yeah. Shut up, Joe.
Oh, you know what? I had a question for you, Joe. Thank you very much, Troll. I really appreciate it. It's some wonderful information. But before we close up for tonight, I there was one question I wanted to ask you, Joel, about your the Echo show.
The show, yes.
Can you browse the web on it?
That's a really good question.
Cause like I was like wondering, it looks like it's a portable, you can move it around, correct?
No, it's got a like a barrel connector, so I mean it's not rechargeable. If I unplug it, it'll come right out and turn off. So, but what I can do, like for example, I can watch Prime Video on it.
Oh, because I was wondering, like if you had it in the kitchen or something, could you use it to like show recipes?
Yeah, you could do that.
Okay.
Like. So there we go. Like I'm looking up a recipe for sugar cookies, and the best rolled sugar cookies, number one.
For sugar daddies.
Yeah, there we go. It added stuff. So it had best rolled sugar cookies to my shopping list. That's funny. But yeah, I mean, it's, you can do stuff like that, or like I can have it look up the weather. It's got a little bit more to do. I think in some respects it has more than it depends. It just depends. There's certain like services that'll have access. Like there's a like different skills they have that work with the Echo protocols that will let you do things. So, I mean, there's not like a straight up browser on it. It is for sure Android based. You can actually tell that it's Android based. The settings and it basically can upgrade firmware just like any Android device. So it's definitely, well, technically based on Fire OS, which is a fork of Android. So it's the same kind of stuff that's in the tablet, but with a little more hands-off kind of stuff. It has a better speaker than the Echo Dots do. So, although I haven't tried, the new one is kind of nice. The new Echo Dot, kind of one nice thing about it is it actually has, on the side of it, it actually has a clock on the speaker-based dot. So the clock's on the dot. So it'd be nice, like stick in your bedroom or something like that. But again, yeah, these are, you know, there are privacy concerns with these. I'll admit that. You know, for me though, you know, I'm okay with audio as long as
we know
it's not...
where you are. Greetings, the NSA.
Yes, but I know I'm okay with the audio, but not cameras. Obviously, audio is fine. You can record what I say all fucking day. It's not that exciting.
So what you're saying is that you have the same concerns as a 15-year-old girl?
No, not really.
Not really. You know, I used to work at a school, and I would see girls all the time putting like tape over their webcam.
Right. I do that too, actually. I've got that on, well, at least on ones that I don't 100% control, like my work laptop. I've got a little, and actually there's multiple reasons for that, but I got one of those, I ordered a bunch of those little sliders that you can stick over the webcam, and it has a, basically, will slide open when I want it and when I need it, okay? Right. And the main reason is occasionally people will have set up Zoom sessions at work and have it automatically go to camera, which if I'm not, you know, decent, like if I'm not wearing a shirt or something, I don't want. I work from home, dude. I'm not gonna sit here and spend a lot of money on clothes that I don't need.
Oh, dude, I completely understand what you're saying.
Right.
Been there, and done that.
My office also happens to be one of the warmest rooms in the house. It will you know, it'll get to be 80 degrees in my office from time to time. You know.
Right.
So
if I'm
like,
working from home, I'm doing it from my comfy chair.
Yeah. I can't.
In a thong.
Yeah, I could not sit on the couch or in a recliner and work. It just doesn't work for me. I have to.
My recliner.
Yeah, I can't do that. I do have a comfy chair. You know, it's just not as comfy as a recliner would be.
Right.
But you know, so, and I also, you know, when I work, I have a. My laptop's plugged into another screen. It actually happens to be a DisplayLink monitor. Eventually, I want to replace it with that honest to God HDMI or Thunderbolt monitor, just because I want something that has a little bit more screen resolution. Because the DisplayLink display I have is not even, I don't even think it's 1024, but 768. I think it's smaller than that. So it's good for like sticking Slack on it. And or email or something like that, you know, or like this week I've been doing a training session in the afternoons, and I finish that up tomorrow. But I've been doing that, and I threw all the training session stuff over there, because usually they're on the other end. It's probably on a projector in some places, so sometimes it's not easy to see the screen. If I take my 3K screen and project that, it doesn't work.
Right.
It's smaller. So, for a Zoom session, but Zoom generally works pretty well. I'm pretty happy with Zoom. I'm trying to convince my church to adopt it for when we do it, because we're merging with another church. We just started services together last week. And so there's going to be a lot of meetings and stuff where we discuss, well, you know, the general layout of the teams and the church, and also pick our new name. We don't have our new name yet, so we got to do that yet too. But of course, I get to miss the first meeting because I'll be in Orlando Sunday evening. Technically Lake Mary, but flying in through Orlando.
All right, we got to wrap this up, man.
Yes, we do. It's getting late.
Thanks a lot, Trolls, Pat, Joe.
You think Joe. It's getting late? It's like half past four.
Yeah, it's about time for you to wake up, so.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right, thank you very much, man. Really appreciate you coming on, and you're always welcome, so.
Thank you, Dan.
You are welcome. Thank you. Here is your promos, and we'll see you in 1 week. Take it away.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit LHSpodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.
Oh my God, it's Hacker
Public Radio! Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
Hi, folks. This is Chatter. Jay Wisher, Honky Magoo, 5150, and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduk to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script, and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Yeah, with my tongue brush. Shut up. Just shut up.
Daddy has a gun!
It's over.
Well, you were making Egg Foo Young in the kitchen. I was in the dining room having sushi.
Did they ever get you a new promo that doesn't have Fitty in it?
No. No, I didn't ask for one either, but no, I didn't. There you go.
I'll have to convince somebody to record one.
Yeah.
There you go.
Record one right now, Joe. And I can. No, don't do that because I'm tired.
No, no.
And there would be a lot of swearing involved if I did it right now, and that wouldn't be good.
All right. Say goodnight, Joe.
Goodnight, Joe.
Say goodnight, Joel.
Goodnight, John Boy.
Don't be a fool, Joel. Save it for the show. Sounds interesting. I'd like to hear about it.
Hey, all you know is I installed it. Well, I hadn't talked about it Ray on that.
I'm looking forward to it. I am. Did you have a nice, both of you have a nice, or all three of you, because I think Joe's there too, and Cherry Hill Tony. Did you guys all have a nice
Yes,
holiday?
I was off all Thanksgiving week, and it was glorious.
That's awesome.
Yes, massive farts afterwards.
Ooh.
Big log poops, right?
Clog up the toilet.
I'm working, so I'm probably not going to talk a lot.
Nah, now's the time for you to quit. You say, I got to do the show. I quit. Now, are you in the office?
You planning on paying me? No, I'm at the house. I'm just
working remotely. Okay.
Yeah, my evening shift called in sick today, so.
Well, that sucks. It's trolls.
That. Na 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 na
na na.
Wait, what did I not do? Oh, I know what I need to do. Mm-hmm. All right. What are we going to do? Tell you what I got to do. I got to finish uploading all this stuff to archive.org and then fix the website to pull from there. Where a lot of
there's something else I can talk about.
Archive.org?
No, Hulu's changing Facebook lock-in policy. Actually, they're going to be removing it. Woo!
What? I wasn't aware there was a lock-in policy.
You can sign into Hulu with your Facebook login, and that's no longer going to be the case. Really, that's all it is.
Hmm. Well, there we go.
I'm not a fan of that. I don't trust Facebook, you know. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't use those Facebook logins at all anywhere.
Oh, I guess we gotta start the show.
You think?
Yeah, I'm just double checking stuff. Oh, you know, I didn't look at. Yep, there we go.
Really not that long till Christmas when you think about it now.
A couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The year's done.
And I don't know if I'll be on the show next week or not. We'll see. I'll have everything with me that I can get on somehow. But I don't know what's going on Wednesday in Florida.
Oh, you're in Florida next week?
Yes, sir.
Lake Mary?
Oh, Lake Mary.
That's for the annual get-together, right?
It's one of our quarterly meetings, yes.
Oh, quarterly meeting. It's quarterly. So you have to go there quarterly, right?
I guess so. Well, I don't know if it'll always be the same place, but I'm guaranteeing you with our team it probably will be because there's a good chunk of our team that's there. So. And Luke started talking about wanting to go to the National Open for the men. And it's in Reno.
Ooh! You gonna fly or drive?
Well, that's the thing is, if he's gonna go, we're gonna have to tell him he's gonna have to fly because there ain't no way. It's a 30-hour drive, dude.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, it's a long drive, but it'd be fun, right? Wait, is he going by himself or are you going with him?
Dan, have you ever driven out west?
We go with him.
Yeah, I've driven some out west.
I haven't drove it's cross miles, country out west, but
miles and miles of nothing.
Yeah,
yeah, well, I have drove out there, but yeah,
it's an adventure. Yeah, I can see that, Pat. Absolutely.
At least the speed limit's 80.
You'll have fun going over to Rockies, though.
Especially this time of year.
Be trapped like the Donner Party and have to eat your left foot.
You'll have to eat the bowling ball. Now, is he going to participate or going to watch?
Participate.
Oh, that's great. Now, do you have a...
I think...
Does Columbus Airport have a direct flight to Reno?
That's a good question. I doubt it.
You're probably going to have to fly to Denver, is my guess.
Well, and we're trying strategizing how to get his bowling equipment there. And because that's the problem. He's got six balls that he bowls with. So it's like... I guess those are going to be oversized checks because each ball would be is 15 pounds.
I was going to say, if you have 50, you have 15 pound balls, man, how the hell do you walk?
Ha ha ha! I knew that was coming. I don't know if we're gonna, I don't know if he's going to do it this year or not. We'll have to see.
So, yeah. So when he travels with his balls, how does he usually like? How do you guys usually carry him? Do you have to make multiple trips, or you guys just have like a?
He can get them by himself. You know, the bags he has wheels on the bottom, so.
Oh, okay.
You just drag them along. Oh. So in fact, he already got a new one for Christmas early.
That's cool.
But the one thing I have yet to figure out with him is that he may not have bowled for a few days, but what he will do is he will go down. He keeps them down by our front door, okay? And he will go down, open the bags up, and clean the balls, even though he haven't bowled a frame in 2 days. I'm like, what are you cleaning off, dude?
All right, let's pony up. Get this pig started. Nice.
So I'm sure as hell not driving all the way to Reno.
Yeah, that's a fly.
Bum, 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 bum.
And boy, it's shitty timing. Oh Lord, it's. I guess it could be any 2-3 day period between March 21st and July 4th. Holy crap!
Wait, what is?
That's how long the Open Championships are. March 21st through July 4th.
Oh.
And I'm like, holy crap. So I assume they're like weekend squads, probably. He has to determine whether he wants to do a singles and doubles or a tingle or a team, or and that might be a problem is getting a team to go. But it's at the National Bowling Stadium in Reno, Nevada, which I didn't know we had the National Bowling Stadium.
All right. Oh, why is my finger not working? Okay. This is episode 836. And ready?